You're listening to a Least Important Things miniseries.
Ahoy, mateys. Welcome aboard Podcast of the Caribbean with your scalawag hosts, Mike Wynn and Luke Ferris. It's time to set sail. Drink up, me hearties. Yo-ho!
Welcome to Podcast of the Caribbean, a special rewatch miniseries from Least Important Things, where we set sail to discover the legend and legacy of the Pirates of the Caribbean franchise. Your captain for this voyage will be me, Luke Ferris, and my old buccaneering mate, Mike Wynn. If this is your first time here, welcome. This is a rewatch miniseries as part of Least Important Things, which is a podcast about the most important of the least important things in our lives. And we also do rewatch podcasts about Mission Impossible, Podcast Impossible, and Jurassic Park, Jurassic Pod. So welcome. And Mike, are you ready to talk about this first film and this franchise? Like, what are you feeling? Because this is a big undertaking. You could say setting sail on this ocean of films is quite an endeavor.
Are ye be ready?
This could be bad. The puns are going to be flowing like rum.
I'm very excited. Pirates is a franchise that I actually quite enjoy. I know it gets a lot of criticism for how it ended.
I have no idea how it ended. The last one I saw, I think, was the third one.
Okay, so this is what I'm talking about is. Those and I hope that if you are listening to this podcast and you are in the same boat as my friend Luke Ferris, that you would allow yourself to approach these movies with a clean slate, because they decidedly go from bad or from great to terrible to great. So
really,
And I think that the reason why the franchise does not get the
plaudits,
the plaudits that it should is that many stopped watching after the third movie.
This is good. This is good for us to test out, to remember, to reflect on it as we go through the movies. And I think it's a good point to bring up if you've never listened, watched, met us through the audio waves. Hello, welcome. This is a very much we're lovers, not experts type of podcast, which is I'm stealing that phrase from James Bonding. We like to go through these franchises that are maybe not like the top franchise, thinking like Avengers, Star Wars, because a lot of times it's more interesting to dig deeper into them as films and sequential franchises and movies, but also as like fan communities. Like, why do people love these movies? So when we go on these adventures together, we're going to go nitty gritty. We're going to go through details beat by beat of the movie. So it's great if you want to watch ahead, watch the movie, listen to us, or vice versa. Or if you've seen them before, it's a great time to rewatch them. But we're also going to talk about overall impact of the franchises in these movies and why people wanted to watch them or continue to want to watch them or still connect with them. So again, we're not going to be experts on here. We're going to joke. We're going to learn, we're going to celebrate and laugh and go deep into why this series Pirates resonates with so many people. So we're going to have a lot of fun. I'm really looking forward to it, because this first film, Pirates of the Caribbean, The Curse of the Black Pearl, is a great film. It is an amazing film. But first, before we get into that, Mike, what is your journey, your experience, your voyage, trying to think of other sailing puns with this franchise? Like, when did you first watch it? When did you first step onto the gangplank?
So my earliest experience with the movie is how many who are 30 and above have experienced it, which is a sequel to a ride. So my first experience with Pirates of the Caribbean is actually from the ride at and for me, it was the ride at Walt Disney World. But the original ride being at Disneyland Resort in Anaheim. So I remember loving the ride as a child. And then the movie came out in 2003.
Yes, that is correct. Yeah.
So, I had been to Disney World in the 90s as a child and in the early 2000s. And I remember riding the ride. So when the movie came out, I was excited because I liked the ride. And I think as with all young kids, there's a somewhat of a fascination with pirates. I think that just like in the same way that our industry or the movie industry doesn't have a ton of dinosaurs except for one dominant franchise, that is also somewhat the truth about pirates, is that there's a couple good pirate movies, but then there's one dominant franchise. And yes, I am including Waterworld as a pirate movie because it absolutely is.
Definitely.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting because you are a theme park person,
yeah,
fan. You're not as lover, obsessive as most people, a lover. I'm not, but I do remember going on the Pirates ride. I believe it was 2002. And my siblings that are listening could maybe call in and get some more confirmation. Was it in the Magic Kingdom? Do you remember?
Yes. Yeah, it's okay. In the Magic Kingdom.
So we definitely wrote it because I have like glimpses of the pirates and I remember doing it. But this was right before the movie came out. And I don't think they probably didn't add in those characters until after the movie, like adding Jack Sparrow. So yeah, it was. I remember that, but for this franchise, I really remember it because we all watched it as a family. It was such a big deal. My sister was a teenager at the time, so she was probably 15, 16, my oldest sister, and she was part of the Orlando Bloom craze that was started with Lord of the Rings. So I think she loved this film. She used to quote it all the time. I actually reached out to her. Here's a clip of her remembering that experience, that time, that wave of like why these movies were so big, especially this first one.
Mr. Cotton, do you have the courage and fortitude to follow orders and stay true in the face of danger and almost certain death? Mr. Cotton, answer, man. He's a mute, sir. Poor devil had his tongue cut out, so we trained the parrot to talk for him. No one's yet figured how. Right, we're in the sales. We figured that means yes. Oh, I spent a lot of time memorizing stuff from Pirates of the Caribbean. By my calculations, I believe I was around 14 when Pirates of the Caribbean came out. And I believe I saw it in the theater multiple times with friends. Yeah, it was at like a peak age of movies were magical and acting was fascinating to me and set design was just really cool. So when Pirates of the Caribbean came out, it was like just another epic storyline that had all like the best things in it. Action and romance and cool costumes and great accents and fantastic one-liners. Just loved Pirates of the Caribbean when it came out. I think Orlando Bloom had something to do with that at first, but I think Jack Sparrow character just like hook, line, and sinker just got you into that movie. It kind of followed me throughout high school. So all the other movies started coming out kind of like every year. And being a theater nerd, it would just kind of fit everything that we loved. Sophomore year of high school, so I was like 15 or 16, my friend and I decided to dress up as Jack Sparrow for Halloween. And we wore our costumes, full costumes, to school the whole day. And I like talked like him and it was so fun. And I actually held on to that costume like all of high school and used it more than once. There is no other unique character like Jack Sparrow in my teenage years. Like everyone loved it. All of my friends did. Guys and girls. Like it was just like you could all sit around and watch that movie. It kind of goes back to the, like the Swiss Family Robinson, like Goonies type of adventure where there's traps and treasure and I don't know, there's something in all human nature that like loves a good treasure hunt. And you know, I still love a good treasure hunt. I mean, that's why people go thrifting. I do need to rewatch it again just to kind of reminisce a little. Though it would be really annoying to watch it with me because I pretty much know that whole movie by heart. So it would be one of those like annoying, like, please stop reciting the movie before every line. Though I'm pretty sure, Luke, I could watch it with you and you would maybe be laughing along as I recited it. So yeah, thanks for letting me do this.
So I remember going to it, and then I remember that craze that the movie came out. I don't think I didn't see it in theaters, but we watched it as a family all the time on DVD disc, and it's a great fun adventure movie. Now, if you are a listener, go ahead.
You said you went to Disney World in the early 2000s.
2002, so I don't think they had changed it. It was right before the movie.
Well, they didn't change it until actually when the second or third movie came out.
Oh, okay. That makes sense.
Which, that so makes like sense. 2005, 2006, I think it was 2006 they changed.
Okay. So yeah, when that movie came out, I just remember it being a phenomenon. But if you're a listener of Least Important Things or our rewatch series, you know there's a character inside of me called Hipster Luke. And a year later, another film set in a similar era of history came out that became one of my favorite movies of all time, called Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World. And being Hipster Luke at a young age, I love that movie, and I felt that that film was overlooked, and it was much better. It was more cinematic, it was more accurate to history, and it was expertly created. So while some kids were pretending to be Jack Sparrow, I was pretending to be Captain Aubrey fighting the French in the Galapagos Islands. So I had a little bit of a hipster view to this. I love the first one. And as the sequels came out, I became really disenchanted with the whole franchise. So I'm coming in with a little bit more of a skeptical view, but I'm ready to be open and to change and have my heart change. And Mike, maybe you can be part of that journey with me as I open my heart to
Pirates. And I think for me, like as a fan of this franchise, like I fully admit I rode that same roller coaster that everyone else did down to the bottom. And even felt like when the fourth movie came out, like, why? but I saw it because I still just liked Pirates, and I still thought there could be something there. And they were able to resurrect it in some ways. Unfortunately, the damage had been done. So hopefully we can be a small part of the rehabilitation of the franchise for many people.
So if you haven't watched the first one, you could either stop right now, watch it, come back to us. You could finish it out, go watch it. But we're going to release one episode per month. So that should give you plenty of time over the next 5 months to watch every movie and follow along and go on this journey with us, because we love doing that, and we love when folks are watching and listening and connecting with us. And you can do that on social media at Luke H. Ferris on Instagram, or at least Important Things on TikTok, or go to leastimportantthings.com. You can leave a voicemail, email me leastimportantthings@gmail.com. Let us know your reaction to the episodes, the franchise, thoughts, stories, whatever you want to share. We would love to hear from you. And I actually went out and asked like people's favorite moments from this movie. So we'll definitely embed that as we go beat by beat through the film. One that I want to bring up is from Lee. I asked this question on social media: what's your favorite moment from Curse of the Black Pearl? He said none. So I think that is just an indication that there's a lot of divisiveness over this franchise as we dive in. Okay, you're ready for some details, some background of the production of this movie?
I'm very much ready.
You're ready. Let me take a little sip of grog. So, Pirates of the Caribbean, : The Curse of the Black Pearl. This is going to be fun. Lots of colons, long names, too long of names already. We'll get to it later. The naming of this film has a fun history that I think you'll enjoy. Oh, Mike.
Yeah.
So this film was released on June 28th of 2003. That weekend, Mike, you could have seen Charlie's Angels, Full Throttle, Hulk, Eric Bana Hulk, Finding Nemo, 28 Days Later, Bruce Almighty, Too Fast, Too Furious, and the Italian Job. So essentially, you had Basic Cable's weekend movie lineup for the next decade, all in theaters.
Nice.
Pretty impressive. The film made $654.3 million at the box office. If you've listened to our other rewatch series, we're going to follow that box office number. Box offices are numbers that can kind of give you an indicator of what's happening with the cultural zeitgeist. It doesn't mean everything, but it's just kind of fun to follow. And here is the crew captaining this ship. It's directed by Gore Verbinski, who previously did Mouse Hunt, The Mexican, and The Ring leading up to this movie, which is a very interesting trio of movies. Definitely get a lot of Mouse Hunt in here, but not as much The Ring, but definitely an interesting background for Gore.
That was hold an Oscar for a Johnny Depp movie, although not this one.
Not this one. The producer of this film, if you don't know who this guy is, he's made a lot of movies. His name is Jerry Bruckheimer. He's the mind behind the CSI TV shows Flashdance, The Rock, Crimson Tide, Con Air, Armageddon, Enemy of the State, Bad Boys, Pearl Harbor, Black Hawk Down, National Treasure. And they all have a distinctive look and feel. We have orange, red sunsets, comedy action, action adventure explosions, and mainly PG-13 action adventure films. Jerry Bruckheimer is a machine. He made so much stuff in the 90s and early 2000s, still is today. He produced Top Gun Maverick, one of the most premier and well-known producers in all of Hollywood. It was written by Ted Elliott and Terry Rossio, who worked on Aladdin, The Road to El Dorado, Small Soldiers, The Mask of Zorro, great film, my first PG-13 movie, Shrek and Treasure Planet. They were a duo heavily embedded in the Disney community, had done a lot of work, well-regarded, and then also written by Stuart Beatty, who was brought in after the first script pass in 2001. There had been a lot of fervor and ideas and discussions about creating a film based off this ride, which we'll get to a little bit later. Cinematography was done by, this is Polish, I believe, Dariusz Wolski, who previously worked on The Mexican with Gore. He also did Crimson Tide and The Crow. Music by Klaus Baldet. He previously did The Gladiator, Mission Impossible 2, The Time Machine, X-Men, Prince of Egypt, and Extreme Days. That's a little nod for our friends of the pod, Paul Knapp and Jay Ferris. Extreme Days, great film. Go watch it. It's a deep cut. The film stars Johnny Depp as Jack Sparrow, Jeffrey Rush as Barbossa, Orlando Bloom as Will Tenna, Keira Knightley as Elizabeth Swan, Jack Davenport as Norrington, Jonathan Pryce as Governor Weatherby Swan, and I'm just including this as if you didn't know this, Zoe Saldana as Anna Maria. I was watching it last night and I could not believe that she was in this movie. It was a shocker.
Yeah. I definitely forgot about that. When I saw her on screen, I actually thought, that's the woman from the T-Mobile commercial.
Best known from the T-Mobile commercial. This
she looks
film,
like a marshmallow.
Yes. This film was nominated for 5 Oscars. Did you know that?
Yes, I did.
This visual effects, sound editing and mixing, best makeup, all makes sense. And best actor in a leading role with Johnny Depp. Here's the other nominees from that year. Sean Penn for Mystic River, who won. Ben Kingsley for House of Sand and Fog. Jude Law for Cold Mountain. And Bill Murray for Lost in Translation. I think that is crazy looking back now that Johnny Depp was nominated for an Oscar for that performance.
I think it's even crazier looking back that he didn't win. But that may be a different conversation.
Well, you could argue that character, and we'll get into it, but that character's legacy is so great. I would argue maybe Bill Murray and Lost in Translation, that character is probably number 2 as far as legacy goes, but those other movies, maybe not as prevalent. All right. Are you ready for some fun facts, some facts that you can fact check? I don't have the time to do the work for you. Here we go, yes. Mike. Johnny Depp wore contact lenses, which served as sunglasses, so he wouldn't be squinting in the sun all the time. Makes sense. They shot this on location, which is great. It looks beautiful. There's a small scab on Jack Sparrow's jawline that gets bigger and bigger throughout the movie, which I've always noticed.
Yeah,
apparently this was a prank by the makeup artists.
And yet they were nominated for Best Makeup.
Let's just say all the lore around this franchise is Johnny Depp kind of doing whatever he wants.
Not only, going back to Academy Awards obviously are the preeminent awards for movies, but BAFTA awards are not far behind. This movie actually did win the BAFTA award for makeup. So it's great. Oh yeah, it is phenomenal.
And speaking of makeup, apparently the lore behind Jack Sparrow's heavy eye makeup was because they had a lot of makeup when they were shooting the cave scenes because they didn't want to be washed out on film, and they decided to just run with it. Who knows?
Great decision.
Who knows if that was exactly how it happened, but again, you can do the fact checking. I'm not going to do the work for you. Keira Knightley was 17 when she made this movie. We'll get more into Keira and her legacy and her run during that time, but she claimed that she was going to get fired after a few days working on this film, so she only packed a few things when she started filming, and her mom was with her the entire time of filming. Robert De Niro, Hugh Jackman were in the running for the Captain Jack Sparrow role, and then when it came down to Will Turner...
Robert De Niro?
Apparently, he was offered the role, and I don't know if...
All right.
And apparently, he took Stardust because he regretted it. Because he didn't think it was going to make that much money. But I think Captain Jack lives on through Johnny Depp. Will Turner, it was down to Orlando, of course, and then Heath Ledger being another one, which makes sense at the time. Pirates of the Caribbean franchise is the 10th highest grossing franchise ever. The title, as we've talked about, which the titling of these films are, wow, they are something. The title was originally just Pirates of the Caribbean, which makes sense. That's the ride. That's what the ride is called, right?
Yeah.
You would think they could just, yeah, that's fine.
I think it's called The Pirates of the Caribbean, but yeah. Yeah.
Mike, can you guess what executive at that time would make the decision to add a subtitle, The Curse of the Black Pearl? Just take a guess.
I don't think the executive I want to guess was actually there at the time. I want to guess Eisner.
That is correct. Michael Eisner, Disney chairman, 5 months prior to the film's release, decided to add that tagline in case it was successful enough to warrant sequels, as well as to appeal to adolescent audiences. Gore Verbinski, of course, hated this addition because the Aztec gold is cursed, not the Black Pearl. As the compromise, Disney's marketing department agreed to put the print really small in all the marketing in a very small font size, as you can see. So Michael Eisner strikes again.
Hi, Spoon.
So please continue to fact check. I'm not going to do the work for you, but those are some fun behind the scenes bits, and there'll be more as we talk about the next films, et cetera, et cetera. But I want to dive in before we go beat by beat into the background of the ride. Mike, explain what this ride is, the type of ride it is. Again, my memory is very faint from when I wrote it, but
yeah.
Can you explain to listeners who may be like me, who know nothing about theme park rides, what this ride is? Because it's, to my knowledge, seems like it was a staple for Disney.
Yeah. I don't know if it was original upon the opening of Disneyland Resort, but... some of the history, I know a lot of history about this ride because it's one of my favorites. So this is more than what our listeners bargained for, but here's some history. So It's a Small World was a...
After all.
Let's just call this a small world. Was a submission for Walt Disney to the World's Fair. I forget what year, but it would have been in the 50s sometime.
Yeah.
And
for New York, right? Would that be
might
New
be
York?
Right. Yeah, that might be right.
Lovers, not experts.
Yep. And because of its success at the World's Fair, Disney had sort of an infatuation with that ride system, that being a river boat or a boat ride system. And so came up with, and I will say he came up with it because he's purported to be a heavy creative arm with this particular attraction, came up with the Pirates of the Caribbean attraction, which was, as is true with a lot of Disney attractions, it's not a high thrill. It's very much a theatrical attraction that focuses more on smoke and mirrors, let's say. Maybe they may be minimizing the work of the Imagineers that went into it, but it's more practical. It's more of a, it's more supposed to excite the senses than it is supposed to like thrill you.
Right.
It's a dark ride. It's a riverboat dark ride.
Meaning you're in the dark while you're riding.
Yeah. Okay. I have not ridden the Disneyland version. I do know that the rides are very similar, though they are not exact carbon copies. I have ridden the Disney World version a whole bunch of times, including multiple times in the same day. And it has one or two drops in it, so to speak, but they are not like drops like you would on a roller coaster. They're not very steep.
More of a dip. Would it be more of a dip?
And it's very much supposed to take you through, I don't know, like it's just put, it's hard to describe exactly, but it's supposed to be like you're watching a siege and a raid of pirates on a port. And so it has various scenes that you go through, just like if you're familiar with It's a Small World, you travel through various scenes
and the mannequins are moving and there's noise.
There's a lot of show elements. It's actually, I mean, as a child, this ride was amazing. It had so much the work that is done with forced perspective and set building and the practical effects is really a testament to filmmaking and set building. As an adult, your mind is trained better to recognize things that don't make sense. But it's still a really neat ride and still offers, I think, a lot of thrill of the mind, if not thrill of the heart.
So is there a actual plot line to the ride?
Originally, to my knowledge, no. Originally, it was more of like just sort of, it didn't really have a main character per se, and I could be misremembering this. And there may be recordings from before 2006 when the ride in Walt Disney World was refurbished to represent the film franchise. If you ride the ride today, it does seem to have a plot, although it's not entirely coherent. But if you're familiar with the movies, you will. You'll connect the dots.
Because you'd be proud of me, Mike. Last night after I watched this film, rewatched this film, I did go onto YouTube and clicked a video walkthrough of this ride.
Yeah.
I actually watched two because I wasn't sure. I think it was maybe both of the parks.
Okay.
Wow, what a rabbit hole of theme park ride-alongs. My algorithm might be forever ruined. But I did notice that Jack Sparrow's in there, Barbossa's in there on the ship. There, it seems like there was like nods to the movies. There.
Yeah, and I will say, I mean, since 2006, the ride has been refurbished numerous times. So like the Jack Sparrow element was added in 2006, but I don't think Barbossa was really added until even later than that. And then Davy Jones.
It's just his voice, I think, maybe.
Okay.
Maybe they just had Jeffrey Wright. I couldn't really tell because it was someone filming on an iPhone.
Yeah. So
in a dark ride.
Yeah. It is a dark ride. So like if you do try to watch this on YouTube, like you did,
it's not that thrilling.
It's not. And, but it is a neat, it is really neat. And I will say anybody that goes to Disney World or Disneyland for that matter, it should be part of your day.
Well, it's amazing to me that out of a theme park ride, yes, conceived by the Walt Disney, that just was an experience, could spawn this type of franchise. It is pretty impressive because we, obviously, Jurassic Pod have gone through the Jurassic Park franchise, which is similar, based off of theme parks, but it's not based off of a theme park in real world, it's based off of a book. That's the source material.
Right.
This is the source material is a theme park ride. So to be able to, I think first off of this movie, to be able to just say, hey, write a story, write a 2-hour movie based off of this ride, and to have it have the reception it is, and the legacy it has, is pretty incredible. We have to just say that right off the bat.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think the ride would have had an enduring legacy even without the films, just because of the rumors that surround the ride at Walt Disney World.
What rumors?
Have you not heard these?
No.
So the rumor is that Walt Disney himself is cryogenically frozen beneath the ride at Walt Disney World.
Wow.
That is the rumor.
That's just not like a, someone died on that ride.
So Walt, so this is,
what's the reasoning?
This is a tangent, but
this is what you're in for, listeners. If you haven't listened to us, this is the kind of stuff you're going to get.
So obviously the ride, the ride in Disneyland, I'm just reading this now, but the ride in Disneyland did not open until the late 60s, which it actually opened 3 months after Walt Disney died. Okay, well, the ride didn't get to Disney World until even after that. But, and so that's part of like the people who deny this rumor say the ride wasn't even
open. That's part of it. The ride didn't even exist when he died.
Right.
But besides
it was reconstruction. It only opened 3 months after. But anyway, so, it's long purported that Walt Disney, who didn't get to see the opening of Disney World, was cryogenically frozen, or they attempted to cryogenically freeze him because Disney was dying of lung cancer, and anticipating his death, and being a man of great innovation, which is well documented, it cannot be denied, that he knew that there was science or some theory to support cryogenically freezing in order to preserve a body, to prevent death. And the rumor is that he had this grandiose idea to be frozen, and not to be, thawed, let's say, until a cure for his disease, was available. So, so at some point when we were able to cure cancer, he would be,
he'd be back.
He'd be back and would be cured. So that's the theory. And I guess the quote unquote in inverted commas supporting evidence of this is Walt Disney's crazy ideas of just, he's a somewhat crazy individual, not quite of the Dr. Seuss ilk, but you understand what I'm saying.
Yes.
It has many great ideas. And, he also was a man of unlimited resource. And a man of great desperation, and also what was there to lose? He was going to die anyway. so they say this. And the other evidence, this is not exhausted. Okay, Lever's not experts, but other evidence, I suppose you can say this is completely conjecture, but that this is one reason why the ride hasn't been removed from Walt Disney World.
It's a little bit older and outdated style to modern sensibilities.
Yeah. So, I mean, that could quickly be debunked now by saying that the movies have brought in enough popularity. Yeah. But the flip side to that is, if you're very conspiratorial, you would say that they created a movie franchise on the ride to prop it up. Yes.
Oh, my goodness. Well, Disney board, if you're listening, I know you want to. I know you're looking at your numbers. You're looking at your Q2, Q3 numbers. Do not bring Walt back. Just hold. Deadpool 3 will save you. He will save you. All right, let's get into the beat by beat. I love that theory. I mean, that is, out of all the conspiracy theories, I actually really want to believe that one. Like, I want that one to be true, because that would be so insane. I'm ready for fan fiction on that. Okay. If you haven't listened to us, we go beat by beat through the movie. We try to cover everything and have a lot of fun along the way. Okay, starting out, we first see the ship. with young Elizabeth on it. It's actually one of the few, like, very obvious outside of the skeleton CGI shots was like that first opening shot of the boat. And then eventually we get to like the set boat that stood out to me. We have the theme that I don't even know if it's a pan flute or something that kind of boom, 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 like that, that theme that's going to persist throughout the entire franchise. It gets hit right away. This composer has very, very similar type of themes. If you listen to the Gladiator soundtrack and the Curse of the Black Pearl soundtrack, you see the carryover of the themes. There's a lot of sharing of the sounds, but definitely great music that is iconic that you'll hear for the rest. We have Mr. Gibbs introed, and then we have Commodore Norrington, but he's just a Lieutenant Norrington. We have Governor Swan. So we have kind of our traditional Britishness, British stuffy cast immediately established, and then enter Will Turner floating on a dock. He gets picked up. He has a medallion. Elizabeth takes the medallion. And here we go. It's all set up.
Yeah, kind of an interesting setup. She obviously recognized, she very early on, they set up her character for having this infatuation of
with
pirates.
Yes. Yeah.
Recognizing that this boy was a pirate or came from pirates, you know, and then it, you know, that it is now a closely guarded secret of hers. And now she knows something about this boy that he supposedly does not even know of himself.
He doesn't even know himself. I really like these kid actors, especially the one that plays Elizabeth. I remember rewatching it last night. I remember I was actually more the same age as the kids in the opening. So there was kind of that mutual enticement. Like when you open up with a kid that's your age, watching a movie, you immediately get sucked in, even though there's adults later on. So it just reminded me of that feeling. And then we cut to, oh, we see the Black Pearl. She sees the Black Pearl, which I forgot in that opening. She sees the Black Pearl in the distance, flying, sailing away. Which I was surprised.
Yeah. Later on, I mean, I don't know how fast you want to move through this, but
we can fly.
So like later on, no, I won't even, because we haven't even introduced him. So
Okay. Then we go to modern day Elizabeth. Want to do a little aside here on Keira Knightley. 17 when she made this movie.
Crazy.
I think people. Every time I look her up on IMDb or Letterboxd, and I'm like, oh my gosh, she's still in her 30s. She's been around my entire life. Like, I don't know, like, films without her almost. Think about this. She had Bend It Like Beckham, this, Love Actually, Pride and Prejudice, Atonement, all within like a 5-year span. I mean, she was in hit after hit. To do that so young, literally as a teenager in early 20s, to just be in these huge films. And Star Wars Episode One, totally forgot about that. So like,
yeah,
I mean, she's in these under huge movies right
I read
away.
I mean, this is the Star Wars part, but I read that her likeness to Natalie Portman is so, they look so much alike that Portman and Knightley's mothers were not able to tell them apart when they were both in their full
episode
makeup.
One. Yeah, it makes sense. And both young stars, Scott started young, are still at the top of their game, still making films, still making big films today, which is crazy. And still very young in comparison. It's just, I was surprised. Like, oh my gosh, she's only like 6 years older than me. I was like, I didn't even realize that. Like, because you don't even think about that when you see an actress on the screen. You just you assume she's a 27-year-old, 25-year-old playing an 18-year-old.
Yeah.
So how do you feel about, it's an interesting film because it's super funny, it's silly, it's adventurous, but there's some like grounded realities in this film. One is the age difference between Norrington and Elizabeth as a marriage. Like, that's very accurate to the time, it seems like.
Yes.
Especially knowing that she was 17 when she was filming this.
100%. Yeah, I think I think there's a lot of similarities between, and we haven't really introduced him, but you start to see it early on with all three characters, you know, Will Turner, Elizabeth Swann, and Jack Sparrow, that they all have this very rebellious nature, but they all seem, they seem to find themselves in step with one another, which we'll see as we discover through the movie and through the franchise. And so this, this commonality that these characters share of rebellion is very much a pirate's characteristic, but the only one of them that's not a pirate is, Elizabeth Swann.
Yeah. That's a really cool concept I never really thought about, is like they all have rebellious spirits in their different way, and they all come from different places. You have Elizabeth, who is coming from a place of privilege, but also is a woman during that era. You have Will, who is coming from a blue collar, like orphan. And then you have Jack, who has this crazy pirate backstory that I'm sure we'll learn more about, in almost legendary status, but they all come to this kind of like, I want freedom and choice, which we'll see as we get through the franchise. I think in this first film, Johnny Depp does a great job. Obviously the flamboyance, obviously the jokes, but especially that last scene when he talks about like, they bring me that horizon. It's obvious that, and he talks about the boat, like it's about freedom of choice, which I think they all have in their own ways. Will, it's about the choice of like following his destiny and his lineage. Elizabeth, it's like the choice of like, should I, like she's more scared after she gets, and we can jump into after she gets rescued by Captain Jack and then realizes he's a pirate. She was more scared about getting proposed to than having an interaction with the pirate. It sets a really good standard right away of all of our characters. We do meet Will Turner, and he breaks a candlestick. Right then when that happened, I was like, that's like a Mr. Bean joke or a Monty Python joke, which there's a lot of them. A lot of slapstick comedy. It made me realize, like, I think these are comedy movies. Almost.
Oh, yeah. No, they are.
This is a comedy movie. This is not... This feels more like an Airplane or a Naked Gun or a Monty Python. Rather than
I mean, it's just not that it's not quite that, but you're right. I do think that they write their jokes, and you know, I was rewatching The Force Awakens the other day, and feels a lot like a comedy.
There are a lot of jokes in that.
There's a ton of jokes.
You know what it reminds me? You know, it's interesting that you bring that up, Michael, because The Force Awakens was directed by and written partially by J.J. Abrams, who also created the show Alias, which is a very comedic show, but also has a lot of drama. Like, it's that balance of adventure, action, drama, and humor.
All right, so if you're playing at home, that's one Alias.
That's one Alias reference. I can't even say the name.
Did I mention that Universal Podcast Studios has an Alias ride?
No, you're making that up.
I am making that up.
It would be Disney because it's an ABC property. Don't try to pull it on me, Mike. But I would be going to Disney if they did. I would be first in line. First and only. All right. Jack Sparrow's entrance. Does it get better?
It's among the best entrances of or introductions of a lead character in a movie. You know, this idea that he, you know, as he's sailing a sinking ship to shore and bailing water out of it, and his nonchalance, his confidence, but also like his like complete ineptitude, is perfect. I wrote that, what does this tell me about Jack Sparrow without him saying any lines? This tells me so much about Jack Sparrow. And it says that him stepping onto the dock as the boat is sinking, he's literally standing on the top of the mast and steps on the dock as the boat sinks. It's showing me how useless enough he is as a pirate to warrant a sinking ship, but how crafty enough he is to get exactly what he needs at precisely the right time.
That is so good. That is the character. I never thought of that. There's like no, like no lines, just like that interaction where he like salutes the fallen pirates. It is definitely, it is up there with Darth Vader entrance. Yep. Like it is an incredible entrance. We have those two British soldiers, which they are, I think they're going to be, they're in the rest of the franchise, aren't they?
Who? Good
the
question.
The two guards.
I don't know.
I'm trying to remember their names. Very Monty Python.
And Tweedledum.
Oh, Mulroy and Murtaug. Mulroy and Murtaug. Very Monty Python. Great straight men, just playing kind of the dumb character. So many great bits and lines in this film. I think the first half of this movie is almost perfect for me.
Oh yeah, I agree. You know, I actually split this movie into two parts. I did a two-parter. I watched the first hour and like the last, and then the last part of another time. And I enjoyed the first part so much. Not that I didn't enjoy the rest, but the first half of this movie, to your point, is so enjoyable. And really, it understands itself so well.
Yeah. You're going to have a fun time. This is silly fun, but it's grounded in this adventurous world. Okay, so what happens? Elizabeth is invited to Commodore Norrington's ceremony, which I do have to say, Jack Davenport, and I know his story gets even more developed over time in the second one. He is doing so much work for this movie. He's doing a service. Like, he's so proper, so British, so stuck up, but also really funny.
Yeah.
Because he's taking it so serious.
Yeah.
Which I really appreciate. Elizabeth is wearing the corset. She falls down because of the heat, which again, I agree, like a horrible time for fashion. Not great. Not a lot of breathing room. She gets saved by Jack Sparrow because the guys can't swim, which is great. He saves her. He sees the medallion. We're off to the races. Then the famous chase with the line, "The day you almost caught Captain Jack Sparrow." And the movie just starts rolling.
Yeah. Do you know what I find so interesting about this scene is Jack's mission from the moment that he lands on that dock is to steal a boat.
Yeah.
And he tries to entice these men to go and save Elizabeth, who fell into the water. Natalie Portman. Keira Knightley's character. And he very easily, like a pirate would not have a sanctity of life. But you learn actually in this, at this moment, and there's a couple other moments in this movie, that Jack Sparrow actually does hold the sanctity for life. And I think that that's really interesting because of, you know, his reputation as a pirate. It's almost like he's the anti-pirate.
In some ways, but you could also argue that he holds the sanctity of life. And now, he didn't know that was the Commodore's daughter.
Yeah.
Or the governor's daughter.
Yeah.
But he does know that, like, people hold the key to unlocking what he's trying to get at. Like, instead of just killing somebody, he'd rather work with them to mutually either get what he wants or understand. But we know immediately because of his action that he has a little bit of a different.
Well, we see this. He does have a vendetta, and he does have a vendetta to kill, right?
Right.
But we see that he, in his fight with Will, he was more interested in being entertained than he was in actually actually killing Will. And I think Will was the same way. Will just wanted to get something out.
The young person angst watching this a little bit older and like thinking about the Will's age, I'm like, oh, I didn't, when I first watched it as a 10-year-old or 11-year-old, I wasn't understanding the young man angst that Will Turner projects. And he does, and Orlando Bloom does a really great job.
Yeah, and I actually think that that sword fight is as good as any lightsaber duel that we see. It's choreographed very well. It's got plenty of hijinks in it, I think. And
sets the first theme of this franchise, which is fighting while balancing on things.
That's a very good point.
It's a theme that will continue, is fighting while balancing on things, which is, you know, sword fighting is all about balance, but it's a trope that we will see throughout the entire franchise, I expect. Yeah.
So I also find it funny how much Jack worries about his, does he call it, he calls them his accoutrements?
His effects. Without my effects.
Yeah.
like the editor kept that line when Will rescues him. Not without my effects.
Yes.
Now I do know, and you know, listeners, fans of the franchise, that the joke of as an audience, but then we learn the power of these effects and these totems that Jack has.
Yeah. 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 But he loves his hat. His hat is so, it's almost like they coached him, hey, we want you to act like Indiana Jones with your hat.
Right. It's a Disney Indiana Jones carryover or homage to that. I do love when Commodore arrests him and kind of says, like, compass that doesn't point north, one shot, you know, bullet for the gun. And then Jack says, but you have heard of me, which is like great PR. It's like, Jack knows the power of the PR and messaging. That's it is key.
I mean, this will bear repeating so many times as we go through this franchise. I do believe, I mean, we talked about his intro being among the best of any characters, but further than that, Jack Sparrow as a character is among the greatest movie characters of all time. And we will dissect that to the ends of the earth.
I think you have to, I think there's a lot of, you can poke holes at it. And I think there's a lot of jokes, and I've probably participated in them being young hipster Luke of like, oh, it's just a Keith Richards impression, but they own it. And you have to understand that if a character and the lines that a character says get so overused and said, or the Halloween costumes of that character are oversaturated enough, you have to give credit that it's because it is such a great character. And Jack Sparrow is one of the great characters in movies, in movie history, where, and especially because it came from a movie. It wasn't from a source material. It is purely a movie creation, which I think is pretty special. When Jack and Will have that fight, I love the idea that Will knew that he was already threatening Miss Swan, which tells me that either Will was stalking, like he knew what was going on, or he was on Twitter and knew exactly what was going on, because I don't know how he would know that Jack threatened Miss Swan. But I think just Will wanted to fight swords. I think he was very angsty.
Yeah.
And then Jack says, you need to find a girl mate. You need to woo a lady. And then the joke that apparently was improvised and comes back again. He says, you're not a eunuch, are you? And it comes up later.
It's so good.
Which apparently is improvised by Johnny Depp. We talked about fear of marriage or fear of death. I love the line when Jack gets captured. No survivors. Where do the stories come from? It's one of my favorite lines that I remember from this movie.
It is. It's among the most memorable lines.
And it speaks to this idea of like legend and PR around pirates of like, well, if all these legends happen, where are the stories coming from?
Yes.
Then we get, so basically what happens is Elizabeth drops the medallion in the water, which essentially when she goes in the water, essentially sounds a sonic boom signal out to the Black Pearl, letting them know, which they don't really go into that, like they can find them just as soon as they touch water, but it sends a sonic boom signal. The Black Pearl say, hey, get this medallion, and they attack while Jack is in jail. And then we meet two great characters that will be throughout the franchise, which we get is Pintel and Rigetti, more commonly known as the Hollow Puppet guys. bootstraps guy. They have great lines. They kind of steal the show. They are the comic relief of the Black Pearl crew. Casey Felton said that's one of her favorite moments. She also loves the line, "You may tell the captain that I refuse to acquiesce to his request."
Yes.
Which comes up later. So Elizabeth gets captured. She says parlay. And I love that whole part of the film because it shows that Elizabeth is very keen, very smart, very intelligent. When she grabs the sword from the mantle and it falls down, which I think was in the trailer, it's something that I remember the franchise losing is, and almost it happens in this film a little bit, is Elizabeth is pretty grounded in the history of that story where, like, she's a woman in that time. Like, she wouldn't have been allowed to, like, train in fighting or know how to shoot a musket. They would, she was a governor's daughter. Like, there's no way they would have let her do that. Not that she's not capable of it, that they wouldn't have let her. And I think it's great because in that movie, when she gets captured, she's scared, but not, she's not panicking and she's making decisions, and it's her intellect and her mind and her knowledge of pirates that saves her and keeps her alive. But I think the franchise kind of loses that over time. And they just kind of make her an action hero, which is fine. But I think I like this first movie because it's a little bit more grounded in the reality of that world.
Yeah, I'd agree. Yeah, I think that that's fair. I think, as is true with most franchises, they tend to lose certain elements that probably should have grown and drill down deeper on elements that end up not working out. So I don't necessarily know that it's totally a pirates thing, but yeah, your point is valid.
I just like how she's portrayed in this first one much better than I can remember. Now, as we go through this, we'll learn. She gets captured. We meet Barbossa, played by Jeffrey Rush. Great bad guy. Lovable bad guy.
Yeah.
He might return in this franchise. That's how much he is loved. Might. Spoiler alert. What's your take on Barbossa?
Well, I think that, he's a phenomenal bad guy. He's a kind of bad guy that you root for. And the reason why you feel that way is the enemy is actually the British Navy, the whole movie.
Yes.
It kind of feels like the enemy is.
Yeah, they are. They are.
Yeah.
They should be.
They are. Yeah. Those freaking colonists. You learn that him and Sparrow have a history and that, he is become an accomplished pirate in his own right. He's obviously very crafty in and of himself. I love how his dialogue with Elizabeth, I think, is so great, where he criticizes her for using big words, because he is just a humble pirate, but then turns it on her and uses big words by saying, "I'm disinclined to acquiesce to your requests," and then mocking her, saying, "That means no." And I just think that he's a great character. He's one of the only villains, I feel like, that you just feel like you are endeared to.
Right. And especially his whole monologue about, they have the dinner and she's eating. And also, who's the chef on the Black Pearl? I mean, kudos for not being able to taste. That looks pretty good.
Yeah.
And that's a great acting scene. It's very subtle. But when she's she's starving and she's just like gorging all this food, you can see he's not turned on by her. He's turned on by watching her savor food, which he can't. And he talks about that in his famous line where transitions,
We kind of haven't talked about it, but in this sequence, actually, even before this sequence, you learn that these pirates are not alive. They're actually undead. And in that dinner scene that you're talking about, he explains.
That's the curse, not the curse of the Black Pearl, Michael Eisner. Right.
Eisner, you actually learn that these pirates are cursed and aren't able to rest or able to die because they have a quest from the hell, a quest from hell.
Yes, something about Cortez stole and the Aztec priest put a curse on it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a bit MacGuffin-y, but they have to essentially get all the MacGuffin coins back in the MacGuffin chest.
Yes. Rabbit's foot. And
yes. That's for Podcast Impossible listeners.
Yeah, little
Mission Impossible 3 nod.
Yeah. But what was I going to say before I was rudely interrupted. Sidetracked? you learn that there's obviously something far more sinister going on with these pirates. They have ulterior motives, or they have they have a mission, a quest, and that's why they're so interested in what Elizabeth has to offer, which is this piece of gold.
But also, she says her name is Turner.
Yes, yeah.
Which I like that whole like bootstrap Bill thing. I totally forgot how that is embedded immediately, because Jack finds out and then he gets it, and then Barbossa finds out and is like, oh. And we don't know as an audience the first time we're watching. They're like, why is Turner, must Turner mean so much? Why is that such a big deal?
I think they do a pretty good job with that. Now, I will say something I do want to say. Obviously, this movie was nominated for a lot of technical accolades and won some as well. I watched this movie just the other day, and I think the CGI holds up very well.
I think so too. I think the skeleton CGI is strong. I think they use their CGI well.
Is this ILM? Did they use ILM for this?
Yes, this is ILM was part of this. Fun fact, so this production was going on at the same time as Lord of the Rings, especially the post-production crossover with Orlando Bloom. If you watch the special edition of The Return of the King, extended edition, if you have the DVD copy, I don't know if you can get it online, but they talk about how Weta, they were doing the same type of effects for the deserters in Return of the King that Aragorn as approaches. Yeah. So the same type of skeletal undead look. And so in that special features, they talk about, oh, we realized ILM was doing this for pirates, so we had to change ours. So in the Return of the King, they are much more ghost-like. They're green. There's some similarities, but they went a totally different route than the pirates look, but it's because pirates was already working on this. So there was that crossover of two of these huge movies that
they both worked out in their own right. I mean, like,
both did really well in 2003. So,
Return of the King, I think, holds the record for most Oscars.
I think that's probably what beat them out in special effects. So I think the guys at Weta have the last laugh. They maybe weren't first to it, but they definitely have the last laugh. It definitely holds up. It looks great. The whole movie looks great. I mean, there was, again, the opening shot of the boat, that was one of the big, and I've seen some of the backdrops, but all the boat stuff was great. There was practical shot on location.
There's so many practical shots, and I actually thought that was a huge nod to the ride. There's so many practical effects in this movie, and oftentimes when we talk special effects, we mean like a lot of people just mean CGI, but the special effects actually extend far beyond that. There's so many great practical effects in this film. And I felt that was, it could be cost. It could be, just the director, but I actually thought it was I chose the romantic view that it was a nod to the ride.
Yeah.
So I really appreciated it.
Yeah, there was, I think when they blow up the interceptor after they take it over, I was like, wow, they blew that up on the water. They blew up that boat. It looks really good. All right, we have to talk about Will helps Jack escape. One of the quotes that has been said in my family for years is, with the right leverage and the proper application of strength, the gate will go free.
Yes,
it's something that I always say: the right leverage and proper application of strength. And then we have to give a shout out to Andy, friend of the pod, former guest on the pod, future guest on the pod. Said one of his favorite scenes is when they're walking underwater with the boat, and then the first duel with the blacksmith duel.
There's issues with that walking under the water scene.
Yes.
But 100% scientifically works.
No, it does not.
Yes, it does.
No, Mythbusters proved it wrong. There's a full episode.
I'm going to tell you right now, listeners, okay? Listen to me. Take a cup, okay? Go to your sink, fill your sink up with water. Put a piece of paper towel at the bottom of your cup so that it's stuck in there, and then flip your cup upside down, put it in the bottom of the water. It works.
The Mythbusters Pirate Special in 2007 proves this wrong. They get a boat, they go to a pool tank, and you're not able... Yes, the science of it makes sense.
Yes, thank you. That's what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about the buoyancy. Of course, you can't hold a boat underwater.
Oh, okay, okay, of course not. But they did actually do this practically. So I think that's... but still, great scene. Obviously, them trying to get the Dauntless, so great. That's the worst, in doubt, the worst pirate I've ever seen. Little do we know is that Jack and Will are doing the switcheroo. The one thing I did not notice the first 20 times I watched this movie that I noticed last night, when they're walking in the boat, Will steps in the crab trap, and they use the crab trap to disable the rudder. I don't know if you noticed that.
Oh, I didn't notice that. That's funny.
They have a tilt, and you see the crab trap is right on the rudder, which I never noticed before.
Yeah, I never noticed that.
But great scene. They get away.
And it gives purpose. It actually, it gives purpose to stepping in the trap.
It does. That's really good. It does. Yeah. It gives purpose.
It's good detail, it's by the director.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a really good detail. I loved it. We did miss That's Not Good Enough, which leads to, you know, a future scene that JD said is his favorite, but why is the rum gone?
Yes.
Why is the rum gone? If you are early YouTuber like Mike and I from that generation, why is the rum gone? The remix song, this is an era, if you're a younger listener, where people on YouTube they just wanted to have fun. And guess what they would do? They would just make songs from lines from movies. Why is the Rum Gone currently has 33 million views on YouTube.
Wow. I've never heard it.
But why is the Rum Gone? You have not?
No.
I just feel like a middle school boy.
How many years ago was that?
That was 16 years ago.
Wow. That video, that little remix can drive.
That was a pure time in the internet. That's all I got to say. That was a pure time in the internet. Well, friends, we have to fly here because we are, again, we are really, this is, you know.
This is, if you've ever listened to us before, this is exactly what happens.
You know, you're getting to where the episode is longer than the movie itself, but I'm sure you're enjoying your walk or your car ride. Okay, we go to Tortuga. We meet our crew, Mr. Cotton with the parrot. We'll see him. Just that it's a great crew. Great, like, it just is. Character actors, and Zoe Saldana thrown in there.
Which, by the way, she will not make a return appearance in this franchise.
That's crazy to me.
Yep.
Ah, man, it's tough.
I mean, she had other stuff going on.
I was going to say, it's tough because she didn't have a lot of work after that. It's too bad. She had a lot of potential. Opportune moment. I love that kind of theme. We have a lot of, like, word themes, like parlay, the code, opportune moment. I love Jack's joke when they mentioned parlay. That would be the French. Like, who invented that? That would be the French. That's one of my favorite lines.
That's great.
So anyways, they're going after Elizabeth. Right. They go to the cave. They go to the cave twice. So that's why I was a little confused in this movie. I was like, oh, we're already to the cave that can't be found. And then they go back. Because then they go there. That's when they try to sneak in. Will's able to get Elizabeth the code because her blood doesn't work. And then how did they get Elizabeth back? How does that happen? How does because then they chase the boat down. Yeah. So the Black Pearl chases the boat. And then that's when they have that battle, which is a great battle where they have to put like the dishware in the cannons and stuff like that.
I think I fell asleep for that part.
Mike fell asleep. The monkey, not my favorite character in the franchise, the monkey Jack, but people love it. Multiple Davy Jones mentions, which be aware of that. Yep. Foreshadowing, whether they planned it or not, they mention it. I do like when Will, the ship gets exploded, Will swims back and jumps on the boat, on the Pearl, and puts the gun to his neck because he figures out that it's his blood.
Yeah.
I love that scene. I think that's a great scene. Then Elizabeth and Jack get stranded because Will sacrifices his life. They are on the island, which is apparently they're on the island that Jack was first deserted. And there's this lore about him getting away on sea turtles with his back hair,
which is really phenomenal.
He was there for 3 days and we got picked up by the Dutch East India Trading Company.
I think it does a great job. That little snippet where, what's his face? Oh gosh. What's the character's name?
Mr. Gibbs.
Mr. Gibbs makes up that story perfectly. That epitomizes this role of legend and storytelling that exists in pirate culture that like gets thrown into these movies is perfect.
It is. I love the line where Sparrow gets all the rum and he says, "Welcome to the Caribbean, love," which is more of a joke for modern viewers of like you go to the Caribbean to like drink rum and party and sleep, hang out on the beach. That's where he talks about the ship is freedom. Elizabeth gets him drunk. She burns all the rum. Why is the rum gone? I like his line. And then he gets really angry. Elizabeth, again, very smart. Like she knows that the British Navy is looking for her, makes a huge smoke signal. Jack walks on the other side of the island, sees the naval ship. There will be no living with her after this.
Yeah.
Which is a great. Do you think there's chemistry there? Because it definitely is. This thing in the film, to me, it feels.
I think it's more of. I mean, there's chemistry between the actors as they're acting with one another. But I think Jack, being the pirate that he is, lusts for Elizabeth, in kind of like the way that you would expect a pirate lusts after a woman. I don't think there was shared chemistry there.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Elizabeth gets back on, she's rescued and immediately is pressured with like a decision of save Will, and the only way she can do that is by accepting a marriage, which this movie really is about like the bullshit women needed to go through during this era just to get stuff done. Yeah. It's like, oh, I got to marry this guy to save the guy I actually love. That's my only power. We learn about Bootstrap, Will's dad, Bootstrap, where the whole idea is that he didn't feel good about betraying Jack and committing mutiny. So he sent his medallion back to England with his son, which is the whole reason why we're here.
Yep.
Why do we love Jack, do you think? Because he's manipulative. He manipulates Commodore Norrington and said, hey, you could get rid of the last threat of piracy in the entire Caribbean.
He's likable because he's an idiot savant.
Yeah. He's an artist.
Yeah. Yeah. He I don't know, like, you would think, like, that I don't know what it is about characters that we view as inferior, like, to us and intellectually, that we pity them, but we also adore them.
Yeah.
Like Michael Scott fits that characteristic. Right. There's a lot of characters that fit that, and they mostly fall into comedies. Like, this type of character would not work in a drama. You would resent them in a drama because they're constantly derailing the, you know,
pure characters.
Yeah. But with Jack Sparrow, you feel like his derailments are actually just pushing the movie forward. The movie is almost preventing everything from happening, and Jack is, like, forcing the issue.
Yeah, he forces it. That's a great way to think about it. I also think Jack tells a lot of truth. I think a line that stays with me, that Will's like, oh, I'm not a pirate. I'm not a pirate. And he's like, you love treasure. And he's like, I don't love treasure. And he's like, not everything is physical treasure. You know, treasure looks different for different people.
I think, too, is another line that I love that kind of fits in with that is when Barbossa and Jack are talking, and it's right before Jack double crosses Barbossa. He says, like, Barbossa is like, how did I always know, Jack, that you were going to do this to me? And Jack is like, well, because it's because I'm dishonest. And
you can always trust a dishonest man to be dishonest.
Right. And it's honestly, it's the people who are honest that you need to watch out for.
Yeah.
And I just love that so much.
It's a great line. And then they kind of have that fight, which is great. Another great sword fight where you have Will fighting. You have Jack and Barbossa fighting. And then you have the ship battle, because essentially Jack says, hey, before you kill Will and spill his blood, like, the British Armada is out there and you're going to die. So go get him. We have that great underwater walking scene. Hey, boys, take a walk, which is great. It still holds up. It's really cool where they climb the poles. I think it's a great fight. I think the one thing, actually the one part of this movie that took it out of me, is when the governor's like, obsessed with his wig, and that felt a little slapstick for like what is actually happening, where like people are getting slaughtered. Like, it's a very intense fight. I get why that's kind of a graphic, but
like, it is a violent film.
It is. Yeah. Like there's a lot of stabbing. There's not a lot of blood, but like, there's a lot of stabbing, and it's easy because the pirates are dead, so you can do a lot of things there. In that scene, I do feel bad for those pirates that are, they're on the Black Pearl, and they're like looking at this spread of food. It's probably the chef. And they're like, what are we going to eat when we become human again? Like, they're so excited, and they end up getting like turned into bones. So I do feel bad for them. And then one of my favorite lines is when Jack and Barbossa are fighting, and they're like, he's like, are we going to do for this forever? We're destined forever till the trumpet sounds.
Yeah. Cause you find out that Jack is also cursed.
Right. He's sorry. We didn't mention that. He slipped his own, while he was kind of talking to Barbossa, he pickpockets.
This was part of the plan, yeah.
One of the medallions, essentially, which makes him undead, able to fight. We have a great line by Elizabeth. I don't like that she all of a sudden knows how to use a musket, but do you like pain? Try wearing a corset. That's a great, great line.
Yep.
It does feel like throughout the whole film, and especially that like ending scene, there's he's a dishonest man, but you kind of don't know whose side Jack's on until that last moment. And it's more for the audience, but when the last moment, when he throws the medallion, like Will cuts his hand, drops it, he shoots Barbossa. It's a great end of the, like, that's that sequence. Cause as the audience, we think maybe Jack's dead or Will's dead.
It's great.
Because Barbossa's like, you wasted your shot. And then we see that he didn't. Great bad guy death.
Yes.
Great. I feel cold. Which is so good. Like, it's actually, and we don't need to like make this movie deeper than it actually is, but I love that as a bad guy, we relate to him, because the whole idea is that he doesn't feel anything. That's what we first learn from him. And then as he dies, he feels something.
Yeah.
Now,
it's almost like Jack gifted him with that.
Yes. Now, the whole idea is that either Jack has to probably shoot him simultaneously. The whole curse thing's a little bit weird because in my head, wouldn't all of your injuries while you were cursed come to fruition once you become a human again?
I don't know. No, I, you know, the
because
curse...
didn't Barbossa get shot and then he turned, it's a little, to me, it's right on the edge.
No, because I don't read into it. There's other things that you can read into with this movie and you're picking.
There's
this
no
one.
Gigabytes. So we don't have any gigabytes. So we got to read into something.
Actually, my issue with the curse doesn't have to do with that scene. I guess quickly I'll mention my issue with the curse is, and this actually goes all the way back to the beginning of the movie. I mean, you learn early on that, like, under direct moonlight, these pirates are seen as the skeletons that they are. But during the time that Elizabeth is captured originally and brought to the boat, she's standing on the boat and talking to all the pirates, and they're all in flesh. And that it's only...
Is it because there's clouds?
Well, I mean, that's the only explanation.
Yeah, but like the moon, the light of the moon is still illuminating.
Yes.
It's only a full moon, I guess. I guess it's more of like a werewolf thing.
Yeah. So there are moments in this movie where there's light, moonlight, but not skeletons. And then conveniently when it befits the movie. So that's the number one thing I would say is critical. I'd be critical of.
So the British Armada wins. Huzzah, huzzah, which I love. And that is funny when the governor comes out. It's like, huzzah, huzzah.
Yeah, yeah.
It's very, it reminded me exactly like Mr. Bean. Like his whole thing was a Mr. Bean sketch. Rowan Atkinson could have played him in those moments. But the problem is the Black Pearl left the code. They got out of there. So Jack, unfortunately, is going to the gallows. A great final scene. Yep. You have Will Turner is dressed up in a Three Musketeers outfit, which
it does.
I don't know if that was written because Jack says, "Nice hat, love the hat." Like that's all he says to Will.
That is
and then
so
he says
good.
To Elizabeth, "It would have never worked between us."
Yeah, it's such so a great character.
Also, and I don't know if this comes up in the franchise, but while he's being read his wrongs, one of his wrongs is impersonating a cleric of the Church of England, which is I think a great, he's like oh yeah, he like forgot about it.
It's so good.
That's
honestly
a great one. I don't think that comes back later in the franchise, but it's so great. And then Jack falls off the cliff and the pearl is right there. Yep. We get that great final scene, you know, bring me that sun rays, drink up, me hearties, yo-ho. Yeah, and then in that final sequence, I forgot, he says, I think we've all learned a lot, spiritually, ecumenically, emotionally. It's just, that those lines, it's just so funny.
It's so good. I honestly love him so much as a character.
And especially like the opening scenes and the closing scenes for that character are so good. And I don't know if the writing is so strong in this movie, but you got to give a lot of credit to Johnny Depp. I know with modern lenses, he's viewed more as a caricature of a person, but man, he just made this character so much more than it could have been just a very piratey character, and he made it something more that's funny, interesting, that has complexity, and just makes this movie what it is.
Yeah, I mean, obviously he's a highly decorated actor with many roles and noted for his collaboration with directors like Tim Burton, and you know, but I'm gonna be honest, this is his best role. In my opinion.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's...
Without a doubt. Maybe Chocolat, but...
No. He's just super good. I did not realize that in 2016, I'm looking at his filmography right now, he played the role of... Did she know this? In the movie... Donald Trump's The Art of the Deal, the movie. He played the role of Donald J. Trump. 2016.
So, yes, this was a peak moment for Mr. Depp. I think it's over time.
I think this was a satire. Yeah, it's a parody film of the... it's like a Funny or Die thing. So it was like a...
Oh, my goodness. But another moment... The gallows scene might be my favorite scene because he says to Norrington, "I was always rooting for you, mate." just kind of like allows us to be like, this guy can't be owned by anybody.
He is,
and it's all about the freedom. It's all about that skyline. You know, it's all about that whole aspect. Just to wrap up a couple of things, we had one more mention that I know this would have been perfect for our Keira Knightley conversation, but Rob said his favorite moment from this film is when my 14-year-old eyes saw Elizabeth Swann for the first time. that is so good. Rob's favorite moment of the movie, which, yes, Keira Knightley, again, this is peak captivating.
Men of a certain age who are in their... early to mid 30s, all of us had a crush on Keira Knightley.
Yes, Elizabeth Swann. Still do. Well, Mike, we have to rate this film. So typically we do a out of 5 rating system, but we're not doing stars. We like to change it up. We have to like to have our rating system have an icon, a symbol of the movie. So I think pirate flags, does that make sense?
Or Jolly gold Rogers. Pieces?
Jolly Rogers.
What?
I like it. So out of 5 Jolly Rogers, what do you give this movie?
I give this movie 5 Jolly Rogers.
I will give this movie 4. I will give this one 5 Jolly Rogers because I need some space. I think I'm going to need some space for the sequential movies.
You're giving 4 or 5?
5. I'll give 5.
Oh, okay.
So both 5 Jolly Rogers, because I think this is by far the best film in the franchise. But I want some room to play. I'm open.
Yeah. 4.75 Jolly Rogers.
Yeah, I was going to do 4.5, but I'll do 5. It really is. I had so much fun watching it last night. And the interesting thing is, like, I was excited for the next movie. And excited to like watch this franchise because I was like, oh my gosh, there's so much they set up in the first movie, even unintentionally.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, this movie gets you so excited for the next one, and that's why, the following movies were so successful. I'm just looking. The Rotten Tomatoes score on Curse of the Black Pearl was 80%. With an audience score of 86%. So very highly, highly rated movie. As a precursor to the next movie, should I share the Rotten Tomatoes score and the audience score?
Sure.
So Dead Man's Chest was the follow-up movie 3 years later, 2006. The Rotten Tomatoes score was 53%, but the audience score was 72%.
And here starts... the conflict, the battle, the open water battle of this franchise. Mike, this was so much fun. I'm so glad we're in a new world, a new franchise, having these discussions. Thank you, listeners, viewers, for watching, following along. Like Mike said, Dead Man's Chest is next. So watch it, and the episode will be out next month. We can't wait to talk about it more. Hopefully, we will have a special guest for the next film and the sequential films afterwards. Mike, let's dock this boat. Let's dock this ship to port until the next one.
All right.
Ahoy.
Ahoy.